This is Gulf Coast State College, Anatomy and Physiology. My name is Dr. Lee Gonshore, and this is the Lymphatic System and Immunity, Part 1. I'd like to start out pretty much all my PowerPoints the same way. I like to give what I call the big picture. It's always good to have the big picture before you start diving into the details. It's a great way to get organized and really to learn things. So often you'll see on my PowerPoints, I'll start out with a major function slide, a major part slide, then we break it down one at a time and learn the nitty-gritty. So here we go. What are the four major functions of the lymphatic system? Well, for number one, I got some bad news for you, because as you're sitting there right now, wherever you are, you're leaking. It's not that bad. Don't look under your seats for a puddle of water or anything like that. But we're leaking out of our cardiovascular system about 3 quarts a day. And it takes a little knowledge of the cardiovascular system to understand the significance of that. You might recall that our cardiovascular system holds about 5 liters. That's about 5 quarts. If you take 3 liters out per day, which is what we leak, how do you think we'd be doing at the end of the day? And the answer is, well, not very good. I mean, think of a car engine. If there's 5 quarts of oil in the car engine, you take 3 quarts out, the engine is dead. Same thing with us. If we don't get those 3 quarts back into the blood at the end of the day, we're not going to make it to the next day. So function number one, pretty important, return excess interstitial fluid back to the blood where it belongs. Function number two, also important, return leaked plasma proteins to the blood. That's right, our capillaries are not watertight. Not only do they leak fluid into our tissues, they leak a little bit of protein. Not much, but a little bit. And proteins are important. You might remember some functions of proteins. Of course, they're important for our muscles, for our bones, for our cells, for enzymes, for our metabolic processes, so we can't live without them either. So another life-saving function of the lymphatic system, return leaked plasma proteins to the blood. And right here, I would like you to maybe off in the margin, draw a little picture. In class, I usually draw a picture of SpongeBob. And for this part of the course, if you think of plasma proteins as SpongeBobs, that will go a long way. And here's how. If I put a sponge next to a puddle of water, what's it going to do? It's going to suck up the water, right? And one of the major functions of our plasma proteins like albumin is to hold that water in position, to keep it inside the plasma where it belongs. Next function of the lymphatic system is to transport dietary lipids. And lipids, you know, they get sort of a bum rap. I mean, in the news, you hear lipids bad for this, bad for that, and bad for the other thing. But you need lipids to live. I mean, think of the cell membrane, right? That was a phospholipid bilayer. There are some hormones that are made of lipids, can't live without them. We use them for energy. So the lipids that we eat, we have to have a way to get them into our system, and the way they get there is through the lymphatic system. Last on the list, but not least, probably the Mac Daddy of all the functions, is carry out immune responses. It'll all start, we'll see, with the production and distribution of special types of white blood cells called lymphocytes, specifically B cells and T cells. Next comes the major parts of the lymphatic system. This is, again, sort of the laundry list slide. We'll break it down one at a time. The pieces are, number one, some vessels that some genius call lymphatic vessels. There's a fluid inside of them called lymph. Lymph means clear, if you like that, Greek root word. And lymph is mostly clear in most parts of our body. Then we will look at two what we call primary lymphatic organs. They are called primary lymphatic organs because that is where stem cells will divide and mature. So these are key to the immune system. The first one you need to pencil in is red bone marrow. And the second primary organ is the thymus gland. We'll take a look at them in detail one at a time. Next comes what we call the secondary lymphatic organs and tissues. These are where the immune responses occur. These are where the mature B cells and the mature T cells that are developed in the red bone marrow and the thymus gland will be stationed throughout our body to fight the fight. This is where the fully trained soldiers will fight off foreign invaders, infections, cancers, you name it. And these organs are the lymph nodes, the spleen, and then a kind of a tissue we call mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue or MALT. If you're one of my friends out on the weekends, have a little bit of fun, we all call it MALT because it's easier to say and it's fun to say. Let's begin here by looking at the lymphatic vasculature. In the diagram to your left is a little bit of the cardiovascular system. Here in red, I'm tracing an arteriole. Then over in blue is a venule. In between them in purple is our capillary bed, which you know is not watertight. It is leaky. Then we have some tissue cells shown here kind of as a yellowish color, I guess. And in between there, something maybe you didn't learn yet, is this green thing looks like a cactus. Well, that is something called a lymphatic capillary. That is the beginning, I guess you can say, of the lymphatic vasculature. And we're going to trace that just like you traced blood vessels. And we're going to trace it as it follows this pathway to where it's eventually going. I like your book, by the way, because it color codes things. And you'll notice in your book that everything pretty much in green is all the lymphatic kind of stuff. So let's define things. A lymphatic capillary is a blind end vessel located in the tissue spaces between cells where it drains the excess fluid from the tissue spaces. What's the name of that fluid? It is called interstitial fluid. And I love that name because inter means in between. So it's the in between the tissue fluid. Now, you're going to see some people that have an abnormal amount of interstitial fluid. And for my course, you need to know what that disorder is called. It's called edema. E-D-E-M-A. That's where somebody swells up like their ankles swell or what have you. We'll talk more about that later. In most parts of the body, lymph is clear. And it's similar to interstitial fluid. And that should just make sense. That, after all, that's where it came from. The interstitial fluid is the fluid in between the tissue spaces. When it gets inside the lymphatic capillary, it's just a name change game. Once it gets in that green cactus, we just rename it. We call it lymph. So look, don't miss that question on the test. If I ask, what is lymph most similar to iced tea, West Bay fluid, or interstitial fluid, y'all going to pick interstitial fluid. And no, the question on the test won't be that easy, but you know what I'm saying. Then there's always the exception to the rule. Lymph draining from the small intestine is creamy white. Why? There's something in there that's making it look kind of milky or mayonnaise-y, and it's lipids. That's right. That's where we start to absorb our dietary lipids, and they make it look creamy white. Think of it like mayonnaise. Furthermore, since lymphatic capillaries in the small intestine look a little different on the inside when you cut them open, someone had to give them a special name. Always got to name everything in anatomy, right? those capillaries are called lacteals. Why? Look at your root word, lact, like lactate or lactose or lactate. It means milk. So milky looking fluid inside those capillaries gave them the name lacteals. Let's look in more detail at the lymphatic capillaries. In general, if you want to make it easy on yourself, they're kind of similar to blood capillaries. Here's a blow-up picture on the right side of this figure showing some tissue cells with the interstitial spaces, with the interstitial fluid. And then here is the beginning of the lymphatic capillary. Similar to blood capillaries, except what? Number one, the endothelial cells that line them are larger than blood capillaries. And number two, look what those endothelial cells do. They overlap one another. Why do they overlap? The beauty, I hope you will see, of anatomy and physiology over and over again is that the form matches the function. The design matches the mission. The anatomy matches the physiology. In this case, the overlapping allows the fluid, watch my arrow tip, representing interstitial fluid, finding its way, pushing open that large, floppy, overlapping endothelial cell, pushing it open, sneaking inside the lymphatic capillary, but it can't get back out because the trap door shuts. So the overlapping allows fluid to get in, but prevents it from backing out. What happens next? Lymphatic capillaries will merge together to form larger vessels, simply called lymphatic vessels. In general, very similar to veins, except they have more valves than veins. So I want you to kind of stop here and give yourself a big picture point that will help you. Whenever you think of lymphatic vessels, just think of veins, because they're pretty much the same. And you could get almost any question right by just remembering that fact. This reminds me of a story, true story. I was doing a vascular surgery rotation, been up all night for 3 weeks, hadn't slept. And during morning rounds, I knew I was going to get grilled by the attending physician. So the chief resident said, "Don't worry, when he asks you the questions about the lymphatics, just remember they're pretty much the same as the veins." So we go on rounds, and the attending physician says, "Dr. Gonshore," and I wasn't even a doctor yet. I was just a medical student, you know, wearing my little short white coat. And he said, "Can you please tell the group where the left pudendal lymphatic vessel is?" And I said, "Sure, it's right next to the left pudendal vein." Now, that was kind of right. It's not what he wanted to hear. A little bit of a smart aleck answer. He wanted to know where it was. It's really kind of in the groin region if you want to know. But that's how I skated by on that question. Let's talk more about these lymphatic vessels. And this is key. Lymphatic vessels carry lymph into and out of lymph nodes. Lymph vessel into a node, lymph vessel out of a node. Very important. From there, lymphatic vessels will merge to form larger vessels called lymphatic trunks. But before I move on to that slide, some of you are thinking, you know, I can memorize this stuff, it's not so hard, but I'm never going to see this again. Well, here's an example for you. When I was about 5 years old, my dad said, "Lee, go out in the garden and pick some peas." So I went up to the garden, picking some peas. I shoved my hand down into the dirt, and a metal rusty wire stabbed me in the hand. And kind of, after that time, I washed it out, cleaned it and everything. And about a day or two later, what happened was I saw this fine red line, this streak started to run up my arm. And I asked my mom, "Well, what do you think we should do about that?" And she was a nurse, by the way. She was an RN. She said, "Well, I think we should just watch that." Well, what that actually was the bacteria that was inflaming and infecting a lymphatic vessel, causing it to turn red in the perfect shape and perfect pathway of that vessel as it was tracking up my arm. And it was right next to a vein, by the way. So yes, you will see these as red streaks. Let's next talk about the lymphatic trunks. There are five major lymphatic trunks. There is a right and left jugular trunk. They drain lymph from the head and neck. And if you remember cardiovascular anatomy and physiology, that should just make sense. They kind of drain where they are. There is a right and a left subclavian trunk. They drain lymph from the upper extremities. Again, that should just make sense from previous knowledge of anatomy. Then comes a right and left, bronchomediastinal trunk. Now calm down, let the names help you. Broncho, that kind of sounds like lungo, doesn't it? And mediastinal, remember the mediastinum is that place sort of right in the middle of your chest, between your sternum and your backbone, between your lungs, and between your neck and your diaphragm. Remember that space where the heart is and everything? So you got it. The right and left bronchomediastinal trunks, they sort of drain lymph out of the chest region. Then there is one and only one trunk that drains the intestines. And some genius called that the intestinal trunk. Finally, there is a right and a left lumbar trunk. They drain lymph from the lower extremities. From there, lymph flows from lymphatic trunks into lymphatic ducts. And there are two. There's a right lymphatic duct and there is a thoracic duct. Yes, I know it's also called the left lymphatic duct, but when I'm out on the weekend with my friends, nobody calls it the left lymphatic duct. If they do, they get kicked out of my group. Everyone calls it the thoracic duct. I've highlighted them with red expanding bubbles. They kind of they're animated here on this slide. I just highlighted the right lymphatic duct, and then boom, there comes the thoracic duct. Let's talk about them. The thoracic duct is the main collecting duct of the lymphatic system. That sounds like a test question, but whether it is or not, that's a key bullet point, isn't it? What does the thoracic duct receive lymph from? Well, the left side of the head and neck, the left side of the chest, the left upper extremity, and then the entire body below the ribs. So I usually draw a little picture of a person and just draw a line to divide them up. And that picture helps me remember because I remember things visually. So draw yourself a picture at home of that. You must know, by definition, where the thoracic duct begins. It begins as a dilation called the cisterna chyli. Here it is spelled right here, by the way. And if you like your Greek root words, that means juice. Chyli means juice, and cisterna means sack. So it means juice sack. Here it is. I'll put my arrow on it. Then I'll put a red expanding rectangle around it. There's the juice sac. You must know where it's located. It is in front of lumbar vertebrae number 2. And you must know it receives lymph from the right and left lumbar trunks and, this is key, the intestinal trunk. So now, how do I ask questions on the test? Because some of you are thinking, this is easy. I can memorize this stuff, no problem. Well, let's see how you get this. Let's say you're called to the emergency room and you see a trauma victim. and they have severe abdominal pain, you rush them up to the OR to look for some intra-abdominal injuries. When you do your laparotomy, you notice that inside the belly that there is a fluid in there that's milky white. And you say, oh my goodness, the patient's belly is filled with a milky white fluid. They must be an alien. Well, no, it's not an alien. They probably ruptured the cisterna chyline. So why would a patient's belly fill up with milky white fluid if on the test somehow I lacerate or pop the juice sac? Well, you got to put a couple things together, don't you? This slide here says the juice sac gets lymph from the intestinal trunk. Then you got to remember from five slides ago that the intestinal trunk drains or receives lymph that is filled with lipids that make it look milky or creamy white. So you had to put two things together from two different slides. So although you'll see my test, you'll find pretty much every answer in the PowerPoints, you got to be able to put it together, understand it, analyze it, and synthesize it. So that's a good example of how I asked and a good advanced test question. Then comes the right lymphatic duct. The right lymphatic duct drains the upper right side of the body. And just by knowing basic anatomy, you could figure out what's in words down here. If it drains the upper right side, it means it receives lymph from the right jugular, the right subclavian, and the right bronchomediastinal trunks. Now comes one of my favorite slides. Sort of a summary. Talks about the formation and flow of lymph. The picture to your left, a little bit difficult from your book. It shows the cardiovascular system with the heart and the arterial and venous sides. And in green, it also shows a scaled down version of the lymphatic vessels we just talked about. So let's try to put it all together. Let's start with arteries. Arteries go, let's say, down to your arm into blood capillaries. And remember, those blood capillaries are not watertight. They are leaky. And they leak fluid into the tissue spaces. At this point in time, you should remember and write down that that fluid is called interstitial fluid. From there, the interstitial fluid finds its way into lymphatic capillaries, and then it's just a name change game. Now we call it lymph. From lymphatic capillaries, we merge to larger vessels called lymphatic vessels. Please remember, lymphatic vessels go into a lymph node, and lymphatic vessels come out of a lymph node. From there, we go to lymphatic trunks. Then we go into lymphatic ducts. But we're not done the story yet. Because think of the first thing we talked about on the slides. If we take fluid out of a blood vessel, in this case, 3 quarts a day leaking out of our capillary beds, where better we get that fluid? Okay, I know that's not proper English, but you know what I mean. Where better we get that fluid back into at the end of the day, or we don't see the next day? Well, we got to get it back into a blood vessel where it came from. That's a general principle in anatomy. So we have to get it back into a vessel. You must know where the lymphatic ducts dump their lymph. They dump it into the subclavian veins with triple stars. And here I've highlighted with a red expanding circle the connection between the lymphatic duct and the subclavian vein. So here, who cares? You're saying, okay, I remember that. You know, I can remember a list of stuff, but who cares? Well, let me finish the story I was telling earlier. You know, that red streak was marching up my arm and got to my shoulder. And my mom said, well, that's looking bad now. Maybe we should do something about it. I said, yeah, maybe we should, Mom. And she said, well, let's go see the doctor. So we go to the doctor, and the doctor said, you got a bad infection of your lymphatic system. We got to get you on antibiotics quick. Why? Where was that bacteria headed? Well, follow the pathway that was headed into my cardiovascular system. I could have got a blood infection, which could have then seeded into my heart and caused a heart infection called an endocarditis. So if my mom watched it much longer, I could have died. So yeah, this is real stuff, and you got to know it. So what controls the flow of lymph? And the big picture is, you could write down off in the margin, same as veins, because it pretty much is. We have valves, and I pulled a picture actually of a venous valve, but it's the same kind of deal. There's valves, even more valves in the lymph vessels than in the veins, and valves, of course, allow that one-way flow of lymph. Next thing that helps lymph and venous blood move in the same direction is your old friend, the skeletal muscle pump. Remember, when our muscles squeeze, they squish on both the veins and lymphatic vessels. It squishes the liquid above the next valve where it can't go backwards. The final thing that helps both lymph and venous blood move in the proper one-way direction is an old friend of yours again called the respiratory pump. I pulled a picture out of the respiratory chapter just to remind you what happens. When you take a breath in, what happens to that dome-shaped diaphragm? It moves down and flattens out, and it causes increased pressure in the intra-abdominal cavity and a decreased kind of negative pressure in your thoracic cavity. And please remember the overall big picture point. Fluid in the body moves from an area of high pressure to low pressure. So in this case, the lymph and venous blood is going to move up from the belly cavity up into the chest cavity. And lymph needs these things because lymph is not a high pressure system. It's a very low pressure system. It's not directly connected to the pump we call the heart. So these things are critical to keep lymph flowing in the proper direction. Now we talk about some nitty-gritty. This slide is titled Starling's Law of the Capillaries. In English, what's going on here in this busy picture from your book? This is sort of the why, what, where, and how of all the reasons why leakage happened. I told you our capillaries leak fluid. This slide tells you exactly why and how they leak. And yes, I usually ask at least one or two questions about this. Often I'll ask a math problem. I'll work you through one on this slide. If you go to the PowerPoints that I have loaded into Angel, you'll see there's a voiceover on this slide as well, where you can just listen to this slide over and over again and get it down. I can also ask a clinical question on this slide because this is important to know, and we'll get to that shortly. So here's the breakdown on this slide. Here we have a blood capillary that is leaky. Here we have some tissue cells, and then the green thing is the lymphatic vessels. Of course, in between the tissue cells, we have the space with the interstitial fluid. So, I'm going to probably ask you on a test to come up with a number called the net filtration pressure, or the NFP. What does that mean in English? Net means overall, like the net profit in a business is the overall profit at the end of the day. Filtration, just think of that as meaning leaky. So the NFP means the overall leaky pressure. Let's figure out how we come up with that number. And I make it easy on my pea brain. I remember that there are a couple of forces wanting to make the fluid come out of the capillary. I call them the outs. And then there are a couple of forces wanting to make the fluid stay inside the capillary, you know, where it really belongs. And I call them the ins. So let's break it down. There are two forces that want to make the fluid come out. There is a push out and there's a pull out. What's the push and what's the pull? The push is blood hydrostatic pressure. That means blood water pressure. In English, it's just the blood pressure. That's all it is. I will, on the test, of course, give you these numbers. For this example, let's assume the blood pressure at the capillary level is 35. And that's the pressure that's pushing water out of this leaky garden hose. Yeah, you can think of it like a garden hose irrigating the lawn with little pinpricks in it. The next out pressure is called the interstitial fluid osmotic pressure. Uh-oh, let's break that down. Sounds scary. Interstitial fluid, that's the fluid in between the tissue spaces. Osmotic, that means a pulling pressure or a sucking pressure or a sort of a drawing pressure. The interstitial fluid osmotic pressure is exerted by the little bit of proteins that are outside of the vessels in the tissue spaces. There's a little bit that leaks out there, remember? So I draw myself a tiny little baby SpongeBob with one tooth out here, and that reminds me there's little sponges that are really proteins outside the vessels. They exert a very tiny sucking pressure. In this case, let's call it 1. So, what are our total out pressures in this situation? Either pushing or pulling water out? It's 36. Now, we go over to the inside. What are the pressures wanting to make fluid stay inside the capillary? Well, again, for my pea brain, it's easy. Those two forces are, there's a push in and there's a pull in. So there's a push and a pull on each side of this equation. Let's break it down. First, there's a big pull in. It's called the blood osmotic pressure. I'm just going to call it the BOP on the test for short. Let's break that down. Blood means this force is in the blood. Notice on all these terms, this is a key point, on all these terms, the first initial or the first name tells you the location of the force. So in the blood, there's an osmotic pressure. So the last initials we're beginning to notice tell us what the force is. The osmotic pressure, once again, it's the pulling, it's the sucking force. It's exerted by proteins. I draw myself a big, giant SpongeBob protein inside the capillary at this point. That reminds me that's the protein which is pulling, which is sucking, which is holding water inside the plasma where it belongs. It's a pretty big number because that's where the plasma proteins are supposed to be. So let's say in this example, it's 26. Then there's another force. It's the push in. It's called the interstitial fluid because that's where the force is. Hydrostatic pressure because that's what the force is. So in English, in the interstitial fluid spaces, there is a water pressure. That's what hydro means, a water pressure. If you were to jab a needle, I'm just imagining now I'm taking a needle, jab it right in my arm, in between my tissue cells, in my interstitial spaces. And I hook that needle to a pressure gauge. You can measure a small pressure in the interstitial fluid spaces because there's water in there. And it's really small. It's actually really close to zero or one. The example you're given here, and I think the book, the one your book gives, is zero. Let's call that interstitial fluid water pressure zero. But on the test, I can make it one or I can make it two. It doesn't matter. You'll put it in the right place when you do the math problem. And this is a real thing. I mean, if you feel your arm, now I'm not telling you to, but if you were to feel your arm, press on it with your fingers, you'd feel a little pressure. It's called turgor pressure. It feels a little rubbery because there is some water in between your tissue cells. And furthermore, in your dehydrated patients, they lose water and they'll become soft and kind of doughy and squishy because they lose this water pressure. So let's add our in forces together. Let's add the pull in and the push in. 26 plus 0 is 26. So our total in forces are 26. So how do you calculate the NFP? It's easy. You take the outs and you subtract the ins. Outs minus ins. In this case, 36 minus 26 equals 10, and you'll come up with the right number every time on the test. I want you to notice something really important. There's always one big number and always one small number in the equation. The big number pushing out is your blood pressure. And just think of this, the higher you turn the spigot on in your garden hose, the higher the pressure is, the more someone's going to leak, right? And on the other side of the equation, the big number is the protein, the SpongeBob, the pulling, the sucking pressure. So remember, when you're making your equation, there's always a big number and a small number on each side of the equation. And you're saying, okay, you know, I can work myself through a math problem. I'll remember NFP equal to outs minus the ins. I'll remember there's a push and a pull. And I'll remember there's a big one and a small one on each side of the equation. But who cares? Well, you should care because I might ask you on the test, based on the knowledge of this nitty gritty, what can cause edema? What can cause someone to swell up like the Pillsbury Doughboy or the Michelin Tire Man? And you'll see this. Well, look where the money is. The money is in the big numbers. There's two big numbers driving this equation. So two big things can cause your patients to puff up. Number one, you guessed it, is high blood pressure. And you'll see it all the time. Someone will come in on a weekend, their blood pressure in the ER will be through the roof, you know, 210 over 120, and their ankles will be all puffy. Why? Because they're pushing more of that liquid out the leaky garden hose. Another reason that might not be so obvious to you, but it's explained by the equation, is over here. Blood osmotic pressure. In other words, if somebody doesn't have the right amount of plasma proteins, they can't hold the water in their pipes. And if they're missing the sponges, the water is going to leak out. And there's different conditions that can cause low plasma proteins. In third world countries where people are starving, they have low plasma proteins. Often when you see pictures of them, they might look like they're swollen. They're not swollen because they're eating too much. They're swollen because whatever they drink leaks out into their body tissue spaces because they don't have enough protein in their diet. You'll see it in any disease that hammers the kidneys. We'll learn later on that one of the jobs of the kidneys is to hold on to proteins. You sure don't want to pee them out. And if people urinate out too much plasma proteins because of diabetes or high blood pressure or lupus, they'll puff up. again, that's another reason why your patients in renal failure on dialysis, when you put them on the machine, you draw off a lot of water because their kidneys aren't doing their job. Another reason why people can swell up that kind of puts it all together is a disorder I'll tell you about called preeclampsia. What is preeclampsia? Preeclampsia is a not uncommon condition. It's seen in pregnant women. It's usually with their first child, with their first partner, or with a new partner. And what happens is they develop very high blood pressure and they urinate out their plasma proteins. So they have a double whammy. They have blood pressure going through the roof and they lose their plasma proteins. They measure, of course, that on the dipstick or on a chemistry of the urine on pregnant women all the time. They want to know if they're leaking out plasma proteins. So what happens to them? They leak like a sieve. They puff up, again, like the Pillsbury Doughboy. And this actually happened to our oldest daughter. Her blood pressure went through the roof with her first child. She was urinating out her plasma proteins. This is a disorder that can kill both the mom and the baby. They life-flighted her to a major university hospital. We drove in the middle of the night, 14 hours, through the rain to see her. And when we got there, she was laying in the hospital bed, and honest to goodness, I hardly recognized her. She went from probably a normal weight of close to 100 pounds to over 200 pounds because everything she was drinking was just leaking out of her capillaries in her tissue spaces, and she was all puffed up like the Michelin tire man. Let's do one more thing that's a practical application of this. You may have heard of putting support hose on for edema in the leg. Why do you put the tight stockings on the leg for edema in the leg? Just because the doctor wrote the order and told you to? Well, maybe. But I'm telling you right now, the better you understand why you're doing something, you'll do it safely and more efficiently. So you should know why you're doing something. Picture this. Let's say this is the patient's leg, and it's all filled with edema. And then you're going to put on a stocking on the outside of the leg where I'm sort of sweeping my arrows. So what's happening? In class, what I usually do is I grab around this whole picture, and I squeeze. And when I'm squeezing, what am I initially sort of doing? What force in this equation am I altering? I'm altering the interstitial fluid hydrostatic pressure, right? I'm kind of squishing fluid from the outside in. I'm pressing the water that's in their leg with the stockings. I'm forcing it through the little holes in the capillaries and hopefully putting it back inside the lymph, back inside the blood capillary where it belongs. Yeah, also you're probably squishing that fluid into the lymphatic capillaries as well. But that's why support hose works. It's pushing it, pushing that fluid back into the vessels where it belongs. Let's go ahead and break down the lymphatic organs and tissues one at a time in order. Starting with the red bone marrow. Remember, this is one of the primary lymphatic organs. Why? Because this is where stem cells divide and mature. Where is it located? Little refresher, if you already did bone anatomy, I want you to know it's located in flat bones like your skull, like your ribs, and also in the epiphyses. That means the ends of long bones in adults. What's happening there? Stem cells produce fully mature B cells. Here's the way I remember that. B for bone marrow, B for B cells. The red bone marrow produces fully mature, full-fledged fighting B cell soldiers. And what else happens in the red bone marrow? Stem cells divide, mature, and produce what are called pre-T cells. Notice they're pre-T cells. They're not fully mature. I think of it like a pre-teen. They're not fully mature yet either. So what happens next? The mature B cells, well, they're ready. They're full-fledged fighting soldiers. So they are distributed. They are stationed in the secondary lymphatic organs and tissues, which you should know by heart are what? The lymph nodes, the spleen, and MALT. In other words, they're scattered all over the body to fight the fight. What about the pre-T cells? They're not fully mature. They're not ready to fight yet. So where do they get shot? They go to the thymus gland. The thymus gland. Remember, this is our only other primary lymphatic organ by definition. Over on your left, a little picture from your book. Here it is, sort of a lumpy, squishy gland in between the lungs, in front of the great vessels of the heart. Notice, it's a larger organ in infants than adults. That's kind of weird, kind of odd. And with age, it atrophies. Atrophies means it kind of withers on the vine. You should know that it's located in the cavity called the anterior mediastinum between the lungs. That's an important space. Lots of goodies there. Over to your right shows you some histology. I leave most of histology for lab and don't really test on it heavy in the lecture class. But yes, the thymus gland is an organ, and like most organs in anatomy, it is enclosed by a connective tissue capsule, very typical for organs. So yeah, organs, you could kind of lop them out in the OR and throw them across the room like a little football. Now don't do that, that poor form, you'll get, you know, fired. But anyway, that's the idea. And many organs, this is a common theme as well. The capsule will have these little extensions of the collagen connective tissue fibers that will dive into the organ. In this case, those connective tissue extensions actually dive all the way through the organ and separate it into multiple little lumps, like a cobblestone street called lobules. If you ever saw a thymus gland, it does look kind of lumpy, like a bunch of peas smashed together. And the name of these connective tissue sort of endivings, I know that's not a good English either, but those are called trabeculae. Trabeculae are these little beams of connective tissue that divide up organs. Each lobule shown off here to your left under high mag is divided into an outer dark meat called the cortex. Cortex just means the bark of something. And there's an inner lighter meat called the medulla. Medulla, if you like Greek, means a marrow. This will be a recurrent theme in anatomy. You'll be dreaming about it by the end of the course. Many organs have an outer bark called the cortex and an inner meat part called the medulla. Here's the important thing for lecture class. The cortex and medulla, what are all those tiny purple dots? You have to know what they are and what they do. Number one, with triple stars, mostly what's in the thymus gland are T cells. I remember T for thymus gland, T for T cells, and we'll learn their important function later on in this unit. Next, some of those little dots represent dendritic cells, and I love the root word. Dendrite means branches, and dendritic cells have like little branches, and they grab on to stuff that maybe they don't like. And they grab onto it with their branches and they hand it off to the other cells, to the T cells or the macrophages, and say, look, I found something that you need to deal with it. Here it is. Next come the macrophages. I love that word too. Macro means big, phage means to eat. So some of these purple dots are Pac-Man cells that gobble up junk and garbage and debris that doesn't belong. Next comes epithelial cells. Now please, these are not epithelial cells like you may have learned previously in anatomy. They're not like epithelial cells in your skin. These are totally different. I have a whole separate slide on these and we'll discuss their function. Where you may have already seen them in lab is right here. When epithelial cells die, they sort of huddle together, they clump together in a little like a pink swirly looking pancake kind of a deal. And those are called either thymic or Hassel's corpuscles. A corpuscle, let's break it down. A corpse, if you find a corpse, you find a body. Ossal means little. So corpuscle just means in anatomy a little body or a little nugget. And so I like to just remember these as the thymic corpuscles. You may also use the synonym Hassel's corpuscles. I guess Mr. and Mrs. Hassel one night were doing an autopsy late at night. They had nothing better to do. And they were the first ones to ever find it. So they had to name it after themselves so they would be famous. But it's easy for my pea brain just to remember thymus gland, thymic corpuscle. But what's the deal? What's the importance of epithelial cells? They make hormones, all powerful chemicals called thymic hormones. Yeah, that ain't rocket science either. They are what aid in the maturation of T cells. In other words, the epithelial cells, they squirt their thymic hormones on the pre-T cells, and then that grows them up into the mature, full-fledged fighting soldier T cells. Therefore, what's the main function of the thymus gland? You should know, not just for the test, but for real life. The thymus gland has the job of maturing and distributing the T cells. Where? Ah, that's a great question at the bottom of the slide. Where do we shoot the T cells? The same place we shot the B cells. That's the big picture. We shoot them to the secondary lymphatic organs and tissues, to the lymph nodes, to the spleen, to the malt, where they can fight the fight. Another critical thinking question I want to ask you, not too tough. As we age, what happens to our immune system? What happens to our ability to both fight infection and cancer? You will say it gets worse. But why? Well, it was on one of the other slides. This is where you have to put things together and synthesize. Because the thymus gland atrophies or shrinks with age. So yes, our ability to fight off things decreases as we get older. Then I want to mention something. You don't have to know this disease specifically. It's called myasthenia gravis. You can Google it. It's a fascinating disease academically, but not at all to the patients. One of my friends has this. It's a disease where the thymus gland actually makes a mistake, and the T cells that it produces mistakenly kill off what's called the neuromuscular junction. That's where the nerve meets the muscle. And what happens if I cut off the connection between our nerves and our muscles? The muscles don't work, including the diaphragm. So my friend, when he has a big flare-up, he stops breathing. Got to put him in the hospital, put him on a ventilator, give him all kind of drugs, drugs that knock back the immune system. Yeah, that makes sense. But my question to you is this. What if somebody has a disease like this, and all the drugs known to mankind don't work? What do you do next? You say, I'm sorry, nothing we can do, drugs aren't working, you're going to die. Well, let's think a little bit. I mean, you're taking this course not just to get an A, and I hope you all get an A. I'd brag about it. You're taking this course to help people. So what could you do? I mean, think about this. The thymus gland's making a mistake. Drugs don't work, your patient's dying. What could you do to help them? Well, You could do surgery, and you could take out the thymus gland in an adult. And it's done fairly commonly now in patients with myasthenia gravis. And sure enough, sometimes they do a lot better. And you're thinking, wait a minute, but isn't the thymus gland necessary to make T cells? Aren't we going to get a lot more infections and stuff? Well, remember what the other slide said. The thymus gland does most of its work early in life. That's when it's really training our T cells and distributing them to do their job. So actually, they do pretty good without their thymus gland overall. And of course, it's a lot better than dying from the disease. So cool stuff, and it shows you why this is important.